In 1996, a Florida couple was horrified when their dog dragged home a ghastly surprise.
It was a human skull.
It was the first in a series of unspeakable discoveries in backyards of Florida homes.
He's just disfigured. I've never seen anything like it.
Everyone in Southwest Florida is wondering where this monster is.
And the unimaginable only got worse.
As I got closer, I could see his genitals had been removed. I was really concerned because now we have two bodies.
It was a race against time.
We went all out in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week surveillance on this guy. We had a serial killer, and if he gets away from us and kills again, how do you live with that?
Susan and Wayne Brown were up with the sun on the first day of 1996, enjoying the solitude that came with living in a secluded part of Northport, Florida.
It was 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. We have two hunting dogs. Like he does every morning, my husband let the dogs out of the dog pen. Because when they get out of the pen, my husband saw the dogs very curious about something at the base of a palm tree. So he went over there to investigate. I was in the kitchen, I could hear him. I was thinking, oh my God, what is happening to him? At that point, I ran down and looked to see what was going on. I went over there to the base of the palm tree to look, and there it was. A human skull. My first initial thought was just, oh my God, oh my God. And I thought, what's happening? And he goes, we need to call the police.
Officers were quick to get to the Browns' backyard, and the more they heard, the stranger the couple's story became.
We told them the dog's been bringing bones home for about a month. Been picking them up in the yard. And it's like, well, they got a deer, or somebody dumped a cow, or somebody's horses died and they couldn't bury it, so they, you know, dumped it out there.
When investigators examined the bones, they came to a gruesome conclusion.
They found arm bones, leg bones, a lot of little bones, and they were human.
The horror sank in. Who had been so grossly disposed of in the backyard of their Florida home?
I had no idea where those bones came from.
Northport Police Department, they went back into the woods. They found the rest of the remains. The remains were decomposed. They were just basically bones. They did not find any clothing. They didn't find any personal items. They didn't find anything except the bones.
My gut told me that we've got a problem. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist, I guess, but it was scary.
It didn't take long for news of the bones in the Browns' backyard to spread through the quiet town of Northport.
This case was shocking to everyone in Southwest Florida. It's a place where people go to retire. They go there to enjoy the water. It's beautiful. So there was a real feeling of pall in the air. Nobody had a clue. It's all speculation, and no one's gonna be able to recognize that person. And it presents a whole slew of challenges.
The medical examiner's office came out, he collected the bones and transported them back to his office for examination. The medical examiner determined that was a white male. He was probably 25 to 35 years old, about 6'3", heavy built.
While the medical examiner couldn't determine exactly how the victim died, he did declare it a homicide when a disturbing clue emerged. A series of knife marks on the pelvic bones.
We were really concerned at this point.
Who was behind the grisly crime?
Initially, in any investigation, everybody's a suspect until you prove otherwise.
Suddenly, Susan and Wayne were being eyed as potential suspects.
The police came, you know, guns drawn and sneaking up in the yard. Then they started questioning me. Where were you? I was at work. Where do you work? Local hospital. They were suspicious of us because we did not call 911. We called the regular police number and that we were very calm when we called.
Local law enforcement interviewed the Browns, and through their interviews and their questions, they eliminate them as any suspects.
Just crazy. Just crazy.
We knew we were innocent. What are you going to do?
If the Browns were innocent, how did the human remains end up in their backyard? And how long had they been there?
At that point, we didn't even know who the person was. All they knew was it was homicidal violence. Well, our police department interviewed everyone they can as far as leads. They checked the missing persons and tried to identify them that way, but they come up empty.
You know, there's a mother out there, and you know he's got family somewhere. Whatever happened to him? What's that?
Four months into that investigation, detectives Ricky Hobbs and Mike Gandy answered an alarming call 30 miles away in neighboring Charlotte County. There had been another terrifying discovery in the backyard of a new housing development.
I learned two county employees were taking a break or something, but they were just walking around in the wooded area from a nearby paved road, and they stumbled upon a skull.
It's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's just not a place that people go very often.
When I responded, I went into the woods and went back about 50 or 100 feet, and that's where the skull by itself was laying on the ground.
We went in and started to look around a little bit, and then I found the torso of a human being. We assumed that that torso went with the skull that was found by the county workers. Just from the experience, we knew that the torso was there a week or so, or maybe a little longer.
There was no telling what other horrors awaited detectives in the backyard of this development.
Not too far away, I found the remains of a pelvis.
Though seasoned detectives, it was impossible for Gandy and Hobbs to make sense of the scene. And with each step, it became more surreal.
I saw something off in the distance about 100 feet that caught my eye. And as I approached this thing under the tree, I could see a part of a hand sticking out, just the fingertips. So I didn't know whether that homeless guy there, and it appeared to be a carpet padding laying on top of it. As I got closer, I could see what appeared to be blood on the hand. And I called out to Lieutenant Gandy, hey, I've got something over here. I lifted up the edge of the carpet pad, and what we had was another body of a white male. He was what we call fresh, only been there 10 to 12 hours. He had ligature marks around his wrists, ligature marks around his neck, and ligature marks around his legs.
And what detectives discovered next was ghastly.
He was completely nude, and his genitals had been surgically removed.
There was a grisly murderer out there who was tying people up to trees where nobody could hear you scream.
In 1996, after a dog dug up a human skull in a Northport, Florida backyard, investigators unearthed the remains of an unidentified victim. 4 months later, detectives in neighboring Charlotte County discovered the gruesome remains of two more bodies in the backyard of a new housing development.
As I got closer, I could see his genitals had been removed.
I've done this for a long time, and I've seen some pretty bad things. This ranks up there with the top of them.
Our theories on why the genitals were removed was that they're taken to remove evidence. if you're performing a sex act on someone, you're going to leave DNA, you're going to leave something. So by removing that particular item, you're not leaving any evidence.
It was scary to know that we were dealing with someone capable of doing that. And it made me wonder how difficult it was going to be to catch this person.
A skull, a torso, and a fresh body. Were the remains of these two victims the work of one ruthless killer? Or was this simply a gruesome dumping ground?
The fresh body that we found had just been put there maybe the night before.
Who fell prey to these atrocious crimes? Investigators worked quickly to identify the most recent victim.
Well, we were able to recover fingerprints from the victim. We were able to take those fingerprints and run them through a database. And when we did that, we got a hit that they matched a white male identified as Richard Montgomery.
None of us could really believe it. And I think it took a while to sink in. The pictures still haunt me. He was just disfigured. I've never seen anything like it. Just badly beaten.
Just 21 years old, Richard Montgomery was barely an adult. News of his senseless murder crushed his family and friends, especially his buddy, John Jacoud.
I really can't talk.
What?
It's been really hard on me. Richard was living with his sister and his brother-in-law, and they had a young child, and they took care of Richard. They all took care of each other, really. Richard was such a great uncle, you know, and he's always eager to help the family, and he was there for them.
Like most kids his age, Rich hustled through life, always chasing a buck.
He was very eager to make money, you know, doing some construction jobs and things, you know, but just to contribute and help out with the family.
Mostly, John and Rich were just a couple of kids without a care in the world.
They talk about cars and jobs and girls and things that 20-year-old people talked about back then. He was, you know, tall, thin, good hair. He was really good with the women. They loved the way he was. He's just so full of life, and all people loved him, you know? We just wondered how something like that could even happen to Richard. He just did not deserve it.
As Rich's family and friends struggled to figure out why such a loved guy was so viciously murdered, investigators were desperate for answers to these grisly crimes. They started by trying to identify the victim found in the same yard as Rich.
These two bodies that we found were probably feet away. When the torso was found, the back tissue was still there. It was kind of preserved because it was laying on the ground. When they rolled the torso over, there was a tattoo still visible on the back. We basically made that tattoo public to try to find out anybody know a person has this tattoo.
It was a bewildering case for investigators who needed to act fast to catch a killer. But first, they had to meticulously comb through the crime scene.
We're probably not going to find anything that's going to jump out and say, you got it. It's going to be microscopic. So we got to be very careful on what we collect, how we collect it, how we process the bodies.
We did not find any clothing in the area. We did not find any murder weapon. We only could assume that the person responsible for murdering these people took their clothing with them.
Into their painstaking search, the detectives finally discovered a possible clue on the mutilated body of Richard Montgomery.
When he was swabbed, they found a paint chip down by his hip.
The paint chip was collected along with other fibers and hairs. Until the evidence was analyzed, detectives could only hope it would provide a link to the killer. But a search of the backyard did reveal an even more perverse MO.
We were able to find rope marks on the trees.
When you consider the victim's height, the victim had ligature marks. It's at the same levels as the trees, like people were tied to it, and it was rubbing into the tree.
You got a person who's basically tortured these people.
Within hours, word of the horrific scene was circulating through the community of Charlotte County.
As the facts trickled in, we were all wondering, who is doing this? What is happening? They just knew that there was a grisly murderer out there somewhere who was tying people up to trees out in the middle of nowhere where nobody could hear you scream.
As detectives began piecing together clues about this crime scene, they suddenly recalled the bones found 4 months earlier in a Northport backyard.
I called Northport PD and told them, I said, hey, look, we've got two more bodies. At that point, we started comparing notes on our crime scenes, on our victims, and everything seemed to be the same thing on all three bodies. They were all laid out in the woods. They were all naked with no clothing, no belongings.
Was it possible all three deaths were the work of the same sadistic killer?
We went back out to Brown's backyard and looked around, and we found the same ligature marks on the trees up in Northport.
In an instant, the detective's greatest fear was realized.
Now what we have is a known serial killer, and we know that it's going to happen again if we don't catch this person.
In the spring of 1996, investigators in southwestern Florida had a serial killer on their hands when bones and mutilated bodies started turning up in rural backyards. To catch the person behind the horrific deaths, investigators first needed to know who was being targeted. 21-year-old Richard Montgomery was their only identified victim.
We found out Richard didn't have a lot of money. His family didn't have a lot of money.
He drank a lot. He stayed wherever he happened to be that time.
But he had a group of friends that he would hang out with.
Last time I saw Richard, and he was just hanging out, and it's just like a normal night. I'd had a couple beers, and I think someone busted his chops a little bit about money, you know. Richard just told us that he had a way to make money.
He told his friend he had a gig where he was going to go make $200 real quick, and he'd be back in a couple hours.
He didn't put in any details, and he really was very vague about it. It didn't seem like it was a big deal, you know?
The last time Richie was seen was by a couple friends of his. He was standing on Royal Road and 41 like he was waiting for somebody.
Rich's trail went cold on the side of that rural road. Investigators began to speculate. Did someone persuade Richard to meet up with a promise of a paying job? And was that person his killer?
While we're working on this case, we would update the media as much as possible and keep the public informed and to generate leads.
The publicity turned up a critical lead about the tattooed torso found near Richard's body in the backyard of a housing development. When a frantic mother reached out to detectives.
We received a call from a lady who said that she hadn't heard from her son for a while, and he had a tattoo like that. And we were able to identify that it was Kenny Smith.
25-year-old Kenny Smith had recently moved to the area from Naples, Florida.
He would stay at flop houses, missions, do anything for a beer.
Though the bones found in the Browns' backyard had yet to be identified, a victim profile appeared to be emerging. Young, impressionable white men, eager to earn a buck, much like Richard Montgomery.
It appears he lured most of his victims with money.
some of the victims, because of their being transient, they would do things to make money and so forth.
Richard might not have been the smartest guy, and he was easily persuaded, but he wasn't looking to get in trouble, you know, but just very eager to make money.
The urgency to solve and stop these killings was palpable, and investigators quickly set up a task force.
The criminal profiler came down, reviewed all of our evidence and our pictures, and determined in his opinion that the same person was responsible for all the crimes. He said he was most likely a sexual sadist. Basically someone who gets sexual arousal, a lot of the pain, everything that he's doing to these other individuals.
For weeks, Detectives Gandy and Hobbs worked tirelessly to catch a presumed serial killer.
Everyone in Southwest Florida is looking at each other and wondering where this monster is.
With every dead-end lead, investigators feared the killer might strike again. And then, a tip from an unlikely source broke the case wide open.
David Payton was an inmate at the Marion County Correctional Institute. What Payton told investigators was that he was down at Fort Myers. And guy pulled up, offered him some beer, and they got in the car and started driving away.
David Payton said the person that picked him up, he gave him some beer, he gave him some Valium, he gave him some marijuana. And then he said the man offered to pay him for nude photographs with some bondage being tied to trees.
Eager to make a few bucks, Payton went along with it.
Payton says that he made a turn down a road and then cut back into the woods.
Moments later, the car hit a mud puddle and got stuck.
Payton had asked, well, I can go back and push it out. He said the subject's demeanor totally changed, very authoritative. No, you stay here.
The man barked at Payton to get behind the wheel while he got out to push. That's when Payton made a terrifying discovery.
Payton looked around the back seat of the car. That's when he saw a rope, saw a tarp, and a knife in the floor. Now he's concerned.
He came to realize that this was not about photography. This was about violence. This was about murder.
As soon as they pushed it out of the hole, Mr. Payton just floored it and took off. He said he was afraid for his life.
Payton's head was spinning with fear, booze, and drugs when he was pulled over by the cops in Fort Myers.
By the time he was found, the car had been reported stolen.
That's what Mr. Payton was charged with, that and DUI.
Payton tried to explain his harrowing ordeal to the officers.
Mr. Payton had a fairly extensive record. They didn't believe
it. After we learned this incredible story, and we did a little bit of research.
The car had been reported stolen hours earlier.
The car was actually reported stolen through Charlotte County. So I went back, found Mr. Payton's arrest, pulled the reports, and the car belonged to a Daniel Conahan Sr. But the person that reported it stolen was Daniel Conahan Jr.
They learned 42-year-old Daniel Conahan Jr. was a former Navy man who moved to Florida from Chicago and lived with his parents in upscale Punta Gorda.
We ran a background check on Daniel Conahan.
He had been in the military. He had had a dishonorable discharge.
We spoke with the Naval Criminal Investigation Service. Come to find out, he had had two investigations. He had been out on the beach, supposedly approached some other sailors, and hit a guy with a rock. For us, it was a red flag. Now we've got some indicators of some violence.
We learned that he had employment at a local hospital as a licensed practical nurse. Once we learned that he had a medical background, thought crossed our mind about the genital mutilation and how clean the incisions were.
Now I'm thinking we've got a suspect that could be responsible for what's going on.
Thank you.
After hearing a bizarre story from inmate David Payton, investigators were eyeing 42-year-old local nurse Daniel Conahan Jr. as a possible serial killer. After they learned about Conahan's violent past, investigators turned to an old friend of his for more evidence he might be their guy.
We tracked down one of Mr. Conahan's old roommates. And during his interview, he had indicated that one of Mr. Conahan's fantasies was having to do with sexual bondage.
If Conahan was the guy, he's going to kill again. So we could not let that happen. So we went all out in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week surveillance on this guy.
We wanted to see where he goes, what he does, who he contacts.
The first goal is to see if we can catch him trying to hurt someone or establish what his pattern is, to see if his pattern would match the MO of what we believed we had with these murders.
Dozens of eyes followed Conahan's every move. It was a time-consuming process, but it paid off when the team began noticing his strange patterns.
Making U-turns, right turns, left turns, just to make sure nobody was following.
He would drive through homeless areas where transients would hang out, bus stations, anywhere he could to make contact with people that were on the street.
We think that he was doing that to find people who wouldn't be missed.
Conahan's patterns were suspicious and aligned with what investigators were looking for.
He made contact with several different people, and of course, that would get everybody's hair on the back of their neck raising because we were scared, oh my God, is he gonna pick this guy up? Mr. Conahan was a hunter. It was almost like he was a starving animal looking for food.
Detectives needed to come up with a plan and designed one that was risky but could ultimately bait Conahan into a trap.
Once we found out what Conahan was looking for, we decided that we would put out some decoys. And we did that in several places where we knew Conahan hunted.
My supervisor came to me and asked me to do some undercover work. I was asked because I fit the profile of the last known victim. The last victim was similar to my age. We were already surveilling the suspect, so we knew that he went into the park. I knew what he looked like, so I just went on foot with a hidden bug on me and tried to make contact with him.
The undercover team anticipated a long, anxious night, but Clemens was in the park mere minutes when things started heating up.
I went into the bathroom, and basically, as I was walking out, Daniel Conahan was walking in. And as soon as he saw me, he turned around and walked right back out and followed me. He was on me right away. Kind of walked slowly, and he approached me, and we just started making small talk. I made up a name and told him that I had taken a bus from Georgia, and I wasn't familiar with the area. I didn't have any family here. We just walked together side by side, just chatting, small talk. The vibe that I was getting from him was that he was interested in me. He was obviously familiar with the park because he led me to about the deepest portion of the park. And then he asked me if I ever hustled before. I said, yes, of course. And then he propositioned me for sex, basically asked me if I wanted to make a quick 20 bucks. Of course, I said yes, because if I would have said no, it would have been suspicious. I asked him to see the $20, and he said he didn't have it. Then at that time, he wanted the two of us to go for a ride to the ATM, and then we would get the money.
We did not want Scotty to get into the car with him because we could not control that.
That was nerve-wracking. We're close by, and we're not standing right there with him, and he's not armed.
Clemens didn't get into the car, and coyly asked Daniel what else he'd like.
He wanted to take naked pictures of me, and he would pay me, and he wanted to do this in the woods, and he explained to me that there would be bondage. Yeah, I'm thinking, wow, this is the exact same MO that he was doing to these other victims.
We're afraid that if he felt something was wrong, that he could just go off and do something real quick. That would harm the detective.
On a hot and humid Florida night, an elaborate undercover operation was reaching a pivotal moment. Undercover cop Scott Clemens just lured suspected serial killer Daniel Conahan Jr. into his trap.
He told me that he wanted to take pictures of me naked, and he wanted to take them in the woods. At the time, our policy was, you know, you can't get naked. So I told him I didn't have time, that I was in a rush to be somewhere else. After I kind of shut him down, I think he started to become a little suspicious of me.
Conahan suddenly stopped his advances toward Clemens and took off, and the operation was shut down for the night. But after so much surveillance and plenty of probable cause on Conahan, investigators already had a backup plan in place.
We conducted a traffic stop on US 41 in Punta Gorda.
I explained who we were and that we were investigating these crimes and that his name had come up in these crimes and that I would like to sit down and talk with him if he would be willing to do that. To my surprise, he agreed to talk with us.
The stakes were high and investigators knew a confession was key. Afraid of spooking their suspect, they didn't haul him into the station.
We had already set up a motel room that was wired with video and audio. So we went into the motel. In the next room was a team that was monitoring this conversation.
Would you like some water?
Yes, I would.
Yes, no problem. Yes, I'm right here.
He was friendly. I think that he thought he was probably the smartest person in the room. And I think that's why he decided that he would talk to us.
We have been investigating the murders that you are aware of. Could you tell me when you first became aware of the murders?
Well, I first read about it in the paper, the articles, what, a month or two ago or something like that, is when I first read about it.
Yeah.
TV.
Okay.
I was nice to him. I didn't put any pressure on him. He was obviously nervous because under the table, we had a tablecloth. You'll see that tablecloth moving rapidly. That's him patting his foot underneath the table. I asked him if he had ever taken part in bondage with anyone.
Did you yourself ever practice such things? Or?
No, I don't do the bondage. I'm not into it.
Conahan had no idea investigators knew otherwise.
They found the guy.
Oh, did they?
You offered him?
Yeah. I offered, but I didn't want to. I didn't do it.
I think it was just last week.
It was just a passing.
You actually opened on this week, is what he said.
Hmm. And I think very well that said, you know, maybe he'd like to do some bondage or something, but we didn't.
I think he underestimated our investigation to that point. He had no clue how massive it was, how much information we had.
I mean, you're talking about murder. I'm asking you questions about, did you just recently ask somebody to time up and you said no? Well, this guy says, yes, you did. So, well, maybe. Well, you did. You did.
All right, so, well,
okay. So you are receiving. I understand that, but let's get beyond the impression.
That is scary.
Detectives waited until they knew they had Conahan backed into a corner, then hit him with another surprise.
We had obtained enough probable cause that Conahan could be connected to these crimes that I was able to obtain a search warrant.
I know you want to call home what you're going to hear there, is that the guy's house right now?
Oh, my God. I was honestly thinking the worst.
Well, I'm sure that the officers that are there already have explained to them our situation.
Oh, my gosh.
What we've done there is we're were starting to search for him.
While he was being interviewed, that's when we processed his house. We picked up some of his clothing. We actually found a quarter-inch rope, pliers, paring knives, tarps, a lot of the items that would normally be in a murder kit.
There was another small but potentially significant piece of evidence the team was hoping to link to Conahan.
One piece of evidence came from the body of Richie Montgomery. It's when he was swabbed, they found a paint chip down by his hip. When we served the search warrants on Mr. Conahan's little blue car, we also collected samples of paint.
The samples, along with the other evidence, were rushed out for testing. Investigators at the motel were hoping to skillfully pull a confession out of Daniel Conahan.
But I most certainly have not tied anybody up. I most certainly have not engaged. You can talk to anybody you want. And I have not engaged in sex with bondage.
I thought maybe once he knew that I caught him in some lies or some untruth that he would maybe give me a little bit more information, but that didn't happen. Eventually, I can tell he's getting tired. He's getting to the point where he may be feeling a little bit threatened. So I decided that it was time to shut the interview down because I wanted another chance to interview him. So I wanted to leave on a good note, and that's the way we ended it.
How's that?
Yeah.
A little frustrating that we didn't get a confession, but we knew we were in the right direction.
Thank you for your time.
Certain Conahan was behind the grisly murders of Richard Montgomery and two other victims. Detectives kept close tabs on him. They were waiting for the test results of the paint chip or for Conahan to make a misstep when another haunting story surfaced.
I was approached by a detective from the Fort Myers Police Department. He says, you know, we had one just like that down at Fort Myers. And I said, excuse me? He says, yeah, we had one just like that, but ours lived. I said, what?
In 1996, detectives in Florida were closing in on Daniel Conahan Jr., a suspected serial killer. They finally got a major break in the case after another victim narrowly escaped death.
This victim was picked up, taken to the woods, given narcotics, lightly tied to a tree, and then cinched.
He took some pictures and then gave him the excuse, well, I gotta adjust this, adjust that. And the next thing you know, the guy's pinned up against a tree.
The victim was able to stay alive by pretending to pass out. We showed this detective a photograph of Richard Montgomery's injuries. And he said, oh my God. Those injuries are identical to the injuries that my victim had.
Detectives give him a photo array of six photographs. As soon as they laid that lineup on the table, he put his finger, boom. That's him. That was Daniel Conahan. We had more than sufficient evidence. The judge agreed, and we arrested him.
We charged him with the attempted murder and rape of this other victim.
Daniel Conahan was safely off the streets. But to charge him with the murders of Richard Montgomery or Kenny Smith, investigators needed more evidence.
During the examination at the medical examiner's office, when Richard Montgomery was swabbed, they found a paint chip by his hip. When we served the search warrants on Mr. Conahan's car, we also collected samples of paint. We were able to process those paint samples, and these two particular samples matched. That paint chip puts Mr. Conahan's car with Mr. Montgomery.
That was huge. We were able to establish we had physical evidence, We had his MO. We had enough at that time that we charged him with the murder of Richard Montgomery.
This is a big relief to a lot of people and a little bit of closure to what happened to Richard.
It just makes you wonder the depth of his insanity. Because at the bottom of this, there's definitely a very sick, twisted mind.
With the help of one fortunate survivor and the collection of evidence, detectives piece together exactly how Daniel Conahan carried out his horrific crimes.
Mr. Conahan would pick them up. They would be going back into the woods under the guise of posing nude in a bondage scenario. And he would offer them anywhere from $20 to $150, $200.
He would call a light bondage, which would be ropes tied around them very loosely. He had a method somehow of cinching those ropes to where his victims could not protect themselves and could not fight back.
Ultimately, he would strangle them.
Without enough evidence to tie him to the murder of Kenny Smith, Daniel Conahan Jr. stood trial for the murder of Richard Montgomery on August 9th, 1999.
Mr. Conahan pled not guilty all the way up. He never admitted anything.
After an 8-day trial, Conahan was convicted of first-degree murder.
When it came time for his sentencing, the jury ultimately decided he should receive the death penalty.
Investigators never learned the identity of the John Doe whose bones were found in Susan Brown's backyard. And sadly, they believed even more unidentified victims were killed by Conahan.
During our investigation, we estimated that there were probably 16 victims out there.
To try to understand why a sick killer like Daniel Conahan does what he does is anybody's guess. You see a need to control. And you see that with a lot of serial killers. A whole lot of people remember him. And that's something that's gonna be part of the history and lore of that place for generations.
John Jacoud chooses to remember his close friend Richard Montgomery and the life stolen from him far too soon.
Really spent a lot of time trying to forget about exactly what happened to him. What I like people know about Richard is that, you know, he would have made some of himself. He really would have. He would have had everything everybody else has. That's all he ever wanted. Have a life. And he was that's taken from him.
For more information, go to oxygen.com.